Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law.
Thank you. At this time, we're on record in Barrett versus Clark County School District number 161. On behalf of the appellants Barrett, Mr. Jacob Wessel will argue. On behalf of Clark County School District, Ryan Jacobson will argue, and Blake Hall will appear only. Any preliminary matters?
No, Your Honor.
No, Your Honor.
May proceed, sir.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jacob Wessel. I represent Ronald Ryan Barrett, who goes by Ryan, and his wife, Lainey Barrett, and they work for Clark County School District from 2009 until 2012. And up until 2012, in June, when they were terminated, they had always had positive performance evaluations and got raises every year when they were available. But in the beginning of that year, there were some complaints about a propane smell in the old gym in Du Bois, Idaho. And Ryan, who was the maintenance man, was trying to figure out what was wrong and trying to fix it. And eventually by March, he contacted Mike Holden at Sermon Service and Electric to come look at it. And he did some research, and Mike Holden looked at it and determined that there was a building code violation because the propane tank was too small for the system. And he gave Ryan Barrett a letter, in the letter, it said that the propane system was not up to law and did not meet code. The first thing that Mr. Barrett did when he got that letter is he took it to Superintendent David Kearns. And in 2012, there were some budget problems for schools. And Mr. Kearns asked Mr. Barrett to keep quiet about this building code violation. And they argued about it, and Mr. Kearns cussed it, Mr. Barrett, and Mr. Barrett said, well, if you won't handle it, then I'll take it above your head to the school board, which is what he did immediately after that meeting. Mr. Kearns considered this to be insubordination, and from that time forward until he terminated Mr. Barrett and his wife, the lunchroom supervisor, Lane Barrett, in June, he constantly harassed them daily, calling them, threatening Ms. Barrett's job and Mr. Barrett's job, and did a few things that were adverse employment actions as well. First thing he did was the Barretts were living in a school-owned trailer, and he, without talking to the Barretts, raised the rent on this trailer by $300. And this trailer was under a written lease signed by Lainey Barrett, not Ryan Barrett, but he raised the rent, and the reason he said for raising the rent was because he thought that it would affect Mr. Barrett's Social Security disability income. But he didn't talk with them. The Barretts contend that it would not have affected, and it never did affect his Social Security income. The next thing that happened was the school board called Ryan Barrett to come and testify before an inductive committee on May 17th about Mr. Kearns and his unwillingness to deal with the propane issue. So Mr. Barrett and Mike Holden and Randy Mead from High Plains Propane all went before the board and testified that Mr. Kearns was unwilling to address the problem with propane tanks and it had been going on since 2011, basically. And after that, a member of the school board, Sherry Mead, approached both Ryan Barrett and Lane Barrett and told them that the school board had chosen to ask for Mr. Kearns' resignation based on Mr. Barrett's testimony. And they wrote that on a calendar that's in your record on the day that happened on May 17th. After that, the harassment increased, and it was daily, and it got really severe. And then on June 27th, Mr. Kearns sent a letter to both Brian Barrett and Lane Barrett, and each sent them each a letter and said that they're fired because they don't work for the district. They have to, they're evicted from their home. And this was sent on June 27th, and the letter said they're evicted. They had to leave by July 9th, so 12 days notice. And this was despite the fact that they had a written lease that did not require them to work for the school district to live in school-owned housing. Okay, so that's what happened. The procedural history on this case, I think, is pretty important here. We filed this claim initially in federal court, and in federal district court, the school district filed a motion for summary judgment, and we had Judge Lodge, and as his practice, we didn't have a hearing, but he found for the school district on summary judgment, and dismissed all the claims, and they included federal claims under the Fair Housing Act and the Americans with Disabilities Act, and also the whistleblower claim under state law, and our claim for violation of Idaho public policy. He dismissed all of those. So we appealed the case to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals found that there is a question of fact as to the reason Ryan and Wayne Barrett were terminated, but Judge Lodge had not addressed the issue of whether Idaho protects the spouse of a whistleblower under public policy, and so he remanded to district court for trial and for the district court to decide that issue. When it got to district court, the school district immediately filed a motion on under 20 U.S.C. 1336 D that gave the district court discretion because there's only state law claims remaining to either retain jurisdiction in federal court or relinquish jurisdiction for filing in Idaho court. The court decided that it would relinquish jurisdiction based upon in part, some statements made by the school district in its briefing. And those statements were because the Barretts opposed relinquishing jurisdiction to the state court because we felt that it would mean we'd have to start over and that it would take longer because we started going for 5 years at that point. We wanted to stay in federal court. But the school district, they made statements, I quote, "While it is true that the plaintiffs will be required to refile this case in Idaho State Court, the state court would then be in a position to quickly proceed to the merits of the remaining state law whistleblower claims." And they also made the statement that both parties would be placed in the same position as they would have been in the federal district court. And so it was dismissed. We refiled and attached a federal complaint to our state law complaint, and those were the allegations. And it was filed in Jefferson County in district court. And we filed our
motion. How did it happen to get filed in Jefferson County?
What's that?
How did it happen to get filed in Jefferson County?
The statute says you can file it wherever the plaintiffs live.
So they were living in Jefferson County?
They live in Roberts. They were evicted. Yeah. So when it got to the state court, we immediately filed a motion for summary judgment for the court to decide whether Idaho public policy protects the spouse of a whistleblower. And that was the one question we asked. And to our surprise, we got a cross-claim for summary judgment in which the school district filed the exact same motion for summary judgment they had filed in the federal district court that had got overturned by the Ninth Circuit. And that the only difference in the record at all is one sentence that was added to the affidavits of Mr. Kern and the school board member that submitted an affidavit. And if you look at the record, the augmented record, page 563, this is the new affidavit. And if you look at this, the new sentence did not fit in with the old affidavits that they already filed because it contradicts itself. So it basically, in paragraph 3, it says, this is the new sentence. Beginning in January 2012, we were working to address the propane issue because I, along with the board, was aware that the leak in the propane system was a building code violation. So they added that they knew that it was a building code violation and that it was a leak in the propane system. That's the only thing that was new to the state court. But if you read on in the same paragraph, it says, beginning in January 2012, we were working to address the propane issue. Sorry, that's the new sentence. But then after that, it says, throughout the winter, We had repeated service calls from both Sermon Service and Electric and High Plains Propane. On each occasion, neither company's instrument was able to identify any propane leaks. And so the new sentence said, we knew the leaks were propane issue. And then the next sentence said, well, we couldn't identify any propane leaks. And then if you go into paragraph 4, he says in approximately May 2012, the propane system was tested, and it was determined that there were numerous microleaks. So this was 3 months after Mr. Barrett approached Mr. Kern with a letter from Sermon Service Electric that said, this is a building code violation. They didn't even know there were any propane leaks from March until May. They found out in May that there were propane leaks. But now they add this new sentence that says, we were aware that propane leaks, which they didn't know about, or they have the data, were a building code violation. And there's nothing in the record that gives a foundation of how they would know that the smell of propane, which everyone agrees, there was an odor, was a building code violation. And so at that point, you have a new motion for summary judgment filed that basically asked the Idaho District Court to overrule the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And it's the only difference is one sentence that contradicts the rest of this affidavit. And furthermore, I took the deposition of Mr. Kearns. And in his deposition, I asked him straight out, did you know that there was a code violation? And he said, no. I said, at some point, did you come to know that? And he said, yes. Ryan told me. Ryan Barrett told him. Because he told him, you know, on March 12th when he got the letter from Sermon Service and Electric. And that was the first time anyone knew. Despite this, the Idaho District Court dismissed all of our claims, our state law claims. So it filed a motion to reconsider. And the Idaho District Court, at that point, resurrected all of the federal claims, the Americans with Disabilities Act claim and the Fair Housing Act claim that the Ninth Circuit had dismissed and Judge Lodge had dismissed. That was again in the state court. And then we had another motion for summary judgment, and then he dismissed everything. And so I think there's two important things for this court to address here. It seems like we need clarification on what the law of the case is and what a court in Idaho is to do when a court of competent jurisdiction like the Ninth Circuit makes a decision. And
so
if they
if we decide that the Ninth Circuit's case is the law of the case, then my reading of the Ninth Circuit's decision is that the district court correctly held that Ms. Barrett did not engage in any protected activity and therefore cannot bring a claim under the Idaho Whistleblower Act. So that would dispose of her whistleblower claim.
She never had a whistleblower claim. We didn't file one because the statute does not explicitly protect the spouse of a whistleblower. It protects someone who blows a whistle on behalf of someone else, but it doesn't protect the relative or a spouse of a whistleblower. And so that's why her claim is that it violates Idaho public policy for someone to terminate the spouse of a whistleblower.
So is the firing of Lainey Barrett an adverse employment action as it relates to Mr. Barrett?
Yes, it is.
So that would give Mr. Barrett damages under a Whistleblower Act for the firing of his wife?
I don't think any court has addressed that.
I know they have,
but
I
would say yes. I would agree that yes, that he would have damages. But I also think she has a claim of her own because...
But not under the Whistleblower Act.
Not under that act because it doesn't address her at all.
She has an action based on public policy or what we're to define as public policy of the state of Idaho.
Right. That's correct.
Have you looked at our recent decision in Eller versus Idaho State Police?
I haven't.
And we address the Whistleblower Act and what it is and what it does. And what I'm interested in is this notion that in Eller we explained that the Whistleblower Act supplanted torts in Idaho for whistleblowing. And so, and that we've got a statutory cause of action. And so I'm interested and you're at a disadvantage because you haven't read the case yet, right. And it, obviously you didn't have the opportunity to brief it. I'm interested in how, if we've delineated the Whistleblower Act as a distinct cause of action that supplanted other torts, what happens if we come in and say that that there's a violation of public policy if you, in essence, if your spouse blows the whistle? And what I'm worried about is, I mean, are we, in essence, expanding the Whistleblower Act in ways that the text of the statute itself doesn't allow?
Right, and that's a good question. If we could have used the Whistleblower Act in any way to protect the spousal whistleblower, if it had addressed that in any way, then it wouldn't be a public policy issue. But it doesn't. It doesn't have anything to protect the spousal whistleblower. And there's some really good reasons why you need to protect the spousal whistleblower if you want a Whistleblower Act, because you won't have a Whistleblower Act for those people that have a spouse that also work for the government agency, because they would, if the court finds that public policy does not protect the spouse of whistleblower, they would just say, the employers would say, well, you can blow the whistle, and you can tell us about different ways, but under Barrett, the Supreme Court said, I can just fire your spouse. And so it would chill anyone who has a spouse that works there, and no one's going to blow the whistle anymore if they have the spouse that works for the government agency.
But let's circle back to what you earlier said, and that is that if Mr. Barrett's wife is fired as a result of his blowing a whistle, then that's an adverse employment or an adverse effect of his having blown the whistle, and if he has damages to pursue for her firing, why does there need to be a public policy that protects her?
Well, the statute sets out the damages you can have, and two of those damages are front pay and back pay. It doesn't specifically say that your damages can be the pay of your spouse that was fired because of it.
Well, in Eller, we said negligent infliction of emotional distress was a cause of action under the Whistleblower Act. So why wouldn't that protect Mrs. Barrett from being fired under those circumstances if Mr. Barrett may pursue the damages that accrue as a result of her firing?
That would be great if the court found that. It would be the same outcome as this. The only problem is her claim is not a tort. It's a contract claim. The court held that in the Hummer case, and that's why you don't have to file a motion notice of a tort claim in this type of case.
Did Mrs. Barrett file a notice of tort claim under the Whistleblower Act?
Under the Whistleblower Act, you don't have to file one. That's banned.
And that's under, right. It just has to be filed. Sorry.
Right.
You're right.
And you don't have to file one for a violation of public policy either for wrongful termination, because that's a contract action under your Hummer opinion.
That's right.
And so it would be different. It's a separate claim. The damages are separate. And I just can't imagine what precedent would be set if this court were to just decide that you can fire the spouse. This court has found that it would be against public policy to fire someone for refusing to date their supervisor, for example. What if in that situation you had the employer say, well, I know I can't fire you for refusing to date me, but I know your spouse is working for the same company, so if you don't date me, I'm just going to fire him. So go ahead and date me.
You say you don't know what the precedent would be. Wouldn't the precedent be that we're not going to add to a statute, that if the statute didn't want to include spouses, we're not going to write that into the statute? Wouldn't that be the precedent?
Well, I'm not asking for the court to do anything with the statute. I'm just asking for the court to find public policy that you can't fire the spouse.
But
it's
isn't
a totally
policy
different
defined by the statute? The legislature, when they passed the Whistleblower Act, had a policy decision to make. We don't make policy decisions. They made the policy that they were making this act personal to the person that's the whistleblower, and for whatever reason, wise or not, we're not going to debate that with them, they didn't include anything with the spouse. Now, if that was not a conscious decision and that was just unfortunate, I guess that raises some issues, but regardless, They made that decision. And you're asking us to say, well, that was a policy decision that they didn't make, and we should make it for them.
Right. I think what your question is the answer. If they didn't mention any spouse in this act in any way, and so we don't know if it's a conscious decision, but it would basically invalidate the statute if you could fire the spouse of whistleblower.
Are you saying she has an independent employment cause of action based upon public policy because of the impact it would have on the statutory whistleblower cause of action?
Yes.
All right.
And because...
It's an independent cause of action.
It's independent.
It does not grow out of the Whistleblower Act.
Right, and I agree. If the Whistleblower Act had said, these are the only people we're covering, we're not covering the spouse of whistleblower, of course, this court couldn't decide what Idaho public policy is. But it doesn't... There's nothing in the statute saying that the legislature even thought of that. But if you look at what the legislature in 6-2101 says, they said it's important in Idaho to protect government employees so that if they want to blow the whistle, that they will be protected. But if in this case you decide that she's not protected, then, you know, for 27% of this school district's employees, they won't have a whistleblower act, and they would never blow the whistle because then their spouse would be fired. But I think...
Is that evidence in the record, the 27%?
Yes, it is. It's in my client's affidavit he filed when he first filed for summary judgment, which starts on... around 340, so it's in there. So the other issue is this law of the case doctrine. So the district court relied on a stare decisis case, the McNeely case about Miranda rights, and decided that it doesn't have to follow any case from the Ninth Circuit because it's because of stare decisis. In that McNeely case, they hadn't read McNeely his Miranda rights correctly. The district court felt compelled to rely on other cases about Miranda, like the Miranda case. And the Idaho Supreme Court said, well, you don't have to rely on these other cases about Miranda that the Ninth Circuit held. But this, it's totally different from this case. This case is a case where the Ninth Circuit made a finding about Barrett in the Barrett case. And so under the law of the case, if it's a competent jurisdiction, the district court needs to follow the decisions from the appellate court.
What's the law that the Ninth Circuit laid out for Mr. Barrett that we must follow, that the district court must follow and that we must follow?
Well, they found that there is a question of fact whether the Barretts were fired because they blew the whistle.
No, just talk about Mr. Barrett. Okay. Just Mr. Barrett.
Right. That's the law. Now, the question is on motion of summary judgment.
Isn't that may be the result, but what's the principle of law? I mean, if you look at the law of the case doctrine, it's a principle of law.
Well, not only. It's findings of a court of competent jurisdiction.
So are you saying that when this case went back to Judge Lodge, if he had made the decision to retain jurisdiction, that he would not have had the ability to grant summary judgment if presented with additional facts or information?
Yes. If he had been presented with additional facts and information, he can take those new facts and information into account and make another decision. That's not what the district court did. It resurrected all the federal cases. It decided that causation, it's going to decide again. And it basically decided that a three-judge panel of Ninth Circuit district judges is not a reasonable person, because no reasonable person would find that there's a question of fact in this case.
And but you just said that if Judge Lodge had been presented new facts, that he could have decided the case differently than it was decided by the Ninth Circuit. And isn't that what the district court did here? It looked at new facts and concluded...
It had one new fact, one sentence, about whether he was a whistleblower, and then it decided...
That's a fact. But those are new facts.
But those are new facts that are contradicted by the affidavit, contradicted by the deposition testimony. And so... And that new fact was only about whether he was a whistleblower or not. It was not about the causation. And causation is a question of fact for the jury anyway. If we look at the Curley case, basically all we have to show is that there is a rational basis to find that the reason that he was terminated was because he blew the whistle twice. You know, he reported to the district court that there was a building code violation, then he was asked to talk to the school board and tell them what Mr. Kearns had done that was wrong. And Mr. Kearns was fired for it, and then a month later they're fired on the same day. You know, there is a rational basis here to decide that that him blowing the whistle was the reason that he was fired. And that's all that we have to show. Ninth Circuit found that. I mean, you have a noble review. You could find that also. But I guess my question is, what would you expect a district court to do if it had come up to you and you had overturned the summary judgment, it goes back down to the district court? Do you want contradictory sentence, meaning that they can rehear summary judgment all over again and then have to come back up to you and have you decide the same thing over again?
Well, what you're suggesting is that if Judge Lodge had gotten the new fact and decided it differently, that it wouldn't have been the law of the case at that point.
If the new fact was not,
a different fact than the one that he got, you're taking issue with the fact that he relied on.
I take an issue with the fact that the only new fact he got was that we knew it was a building code violation before Mr. Barrett gave them the letter saying it was a building code violation. That's the only new fact that they got. And that doesn't make sense because it's contradicted by the affidavit and it's contradicted by the deposition testimony.
Well, you say it doesn't make sense because it's contradicted. Really, then, that's an issue of credibility. And isn't the district court the one that you're basically saying that can't be possibly credible because it's just one sentence and it's so convenient and it's so self-serving? I completely get what you're saying. But nonetheless, that all goes to credibility. And doesn't the district court get to, well, should the district court be deciding credibility, or does it need to take the evidence as it finds it?
Well, it's summary judgment. No, you don't decide credibility.
Right. So therefore, it couldn't decide, well, that new affidavit is not credible because it's a 180-degree reversal. That's what you're arguing. It couldn't accept that argument on summary judgment, could it?
What I'm saying is you have to take the plainest facts to be true. You don't have to take the defendant's facts to be true, and if their affidavit contradicts itself, this court has held that you can't contradict yourself in an affidavit from your deposition testimony to create a question of fact. Here, you're creating no question of fact by doing that. It's the opposite. I don't see how you could do that. And the main point, though, is he also went to talk about causation. There were no new facts about causation. And he found that no reasonable person could have found that Barrett blowing the whistle was the reason that he and his wife were terminated on the same day. And that was error. Unless the court has other questions, I'll reserve my time. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chief Justice and members of the court, my name is Ryan Jacobson, and I represent the respondent, the Clark County School District, in this matter. This court should affirm the district court's decision granting summary judgment in this matter for three primary reasons. The first is that appellants failed to raise on appeal the district court's alternative basis for granting summary judgment and have therefore waived any argument or consideration by this court now on those issues. Second, the district court correctly determined the law of the case does not apply here. And third, the district court correctly determined Lainey Barrett could not receive protection under the Whistleblower Act by way of public policy. With respect to waiver, the first issue, it's critical to look at the district court's decision in this matter. That looking at that decision, the district court did a very thorough analysis and did not just dispose of this case on one basis, but went on to first concluded that Mr. Barrett had not engaged in any protected activity under Idaho's Whistleblower Act, and second, that he had not established a causal connection. And those were the two reasons for not meeting his prima facie case.
Aren't there facts in the record that refute that suggestion? Didn't Mr. Barrett say that he talked to the school board member, and the school board member said that Kearns was fired because he didn't follow up on the propane issue and hadn't kept them abreast of the issue?
Your Honor, that's true that is contained in Mr. Barrett's affidavit. And looking at this, the district court disregarded that because that was inadmissible hearsay, that the district court determined that Mr. Barrett can't come in and say what the school board member, Sherry Mead, had said to him.
Why isn't that an admission of a party?
Because, Your Honor, as the district court correctly determined, that there was no evidence placed in the record that she had had the capacity to represent the school board in that manner. And also looking at the merits of that, Judge Pickett went on in his thorough analysis to determine that even if he were to say, accept that as being admissible, that would have no bearing on his decision. And what he said in that regard, even if the statement proffered by plaintiffs was not hearsay, or plaintiffs had obtained an affidavit from Sherry Mead or taken her deposition, which is what they should have done if they wish to get this.
They don't need to do that. If Mr. Barrett can testify as to what she told him, they don't need a deposition.
That would be true if it were a party admission, Your Honor.
It sure seems like a party admission to me.
Well, what the district court determined, and this is a quote from his decision, plaintiffs have proffered nothing that dictates Sherry Mead was speaking as the district's representative, that the district manifested agreeance or adopted her statement as truth, or that Ms. Mead was authorized to make the statement, was acting within the scope of her agency or employment, or was a co-conspirator. And those are the elements. That's what's required under the rule to be a party admission.
Let's just say I would have admitted it had I been the trial judge. Isn't it error to reverse when you have evidence from a party that implicates the party in the behavior that's criticized by the plaintiff?
Well, Your Honor, even if that were, again, the district court thoroughly analyzed it and took that as being true and admissible, and still said that even considering this statement, that would not change his summary judgment decision.
And counsel, just taking what Justice Degner has been asking you from a different perspective, it sounds to me, as I read the decision, that the trial judge was weighing the evidence. He wasn't just determining whether there was evidence, but he was actually weighing the evidence, and he didn't find the weight of the evidence persuasive. Is that proper on summary judgment?
That would not be proper, Your Honor, and that is not what we believe the district court did here. What the district court stated in its decision is, Ryan has never asserted that he was fired because Mr. Kearns was fired. Therefore, whether Sherry Mead told Ryan that Mr. Kearns was terminated based on something Ryan stated at the board meeting is immaterial to the court's analysis. But with respect to this causal connection to begin with, we take this from a place, and this is where waiver comes in, is that this court has long held, and it's well-settled law, that to be considered by this court on appeal, the appellant has to raise that issue on appeal. And nowhere in appellant's opening brief or the issues presented to this court do the appellants ever mention the issue of causal connection. It's never mentioned. In their opening brief, they address only whether there is protected activity, and then they delve and use a lot of their a large thrust of their argument, and what was presented today is is the issue of law of the case. And so that was their argument, and the court can check that opening brief and review that, but there's no mention of causal connection anywhere.
Let's talk about the law of the case. So the Ninth Circuit, and I'm quoting now, said, Mr. Barrett established a prima facie case of retaliatory conduct by presenting evidence that he engaged in protected activity by reporting a violation or suspected violation of a law. He suffered an adverse action when he was terminated, and the close relation in time between them, among other factors, suggests he may have been fired for reporting the propane issue. Why isn't that the law of the case?
Your Honor, that is not the law of the case for three reasons. The first is that Idaho state courts, the district court in this case, and this court for that matter, are not bound by federal court decisions.
We're not bound by federal court decisions, but we have said in the past that if a case has been decided by a court of competent jurisdiction, which I assume you concede is the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit,
yes, Your Honor,
that we will adhere to that decision because we don't want to try to re-decide cases in the future as they go forward. So why isn't that the law of the case? It's a court of competent jurisdiction. We haven't said in any decision that I could find that the law of the case is contingent on it being an Idaho court. We have said a court of competent jurisdiction, which is much different than saying it has to be an Idaho court.
Well, Your Honor, Judge, the district court in this case did refer to a case from this court. It was English versus Taylor, decided in 2016, and the citation there is 160 Idaho 737. And in that case, the district court went through this analysis on page 87 of the record in its decision on the motion to reconsider, and said it, because it, in its original decision, it had relied on State versus McNeese, where this court stated that state courts are not bound by federal court decisions. And then in his decision on the motion to reconsider, he expounded on that and said, I'm also relying on this English versus Taylor, which the facts of that case were, the plaintiffs filed their complaint in Bonneville County District Court. The case was then removed to federal court based on diversity citizenship. Later, the Englishes filed a motion for leave to file a second amended complaint and sought to add new defendants. The Englishes did not serve copies of their motion or second amended complaint on either of the new defendants at that time. The motion was granted, and the second amended complaint was filed on January 16th, 2014. But that filing destroyed the diversity jurisdiction, and so then that case was then remanded again back down to the state court. And what was significant there was that the federal district court had certified the date that had been filed because there was an issue dealing with whether it had been timely served. And on appeal before this court, the Englishes argued that the federal district court's clarifying order was dispositive because of the law of the case. And this court determined that even if the Englishes had not waived that argument, that this court did determine that there was a waiver there because it had not been raised. But this court stated, it is well established that the decisions of lower federal courts are not binding on state courts, even on issues of federal law. So that's a case where that is actually distinguishable from this case, because here, the second reason that the law of the case does not apply is because this is a separate case. And Judge Pickett thoroughly analyzed that and said, this case was filed in a new jurisdiction, it has a new case number, new venue, and this is not the same case as that was filed in federal court. The Judge Lodge, the federal district court, dismissed that case.
We recently reached a decision in a case that the parties, I'm sure, weren't aware of at the time they briefed this, and it was a criminal case, certainly, but we said that the case number doesn't determine whether something is a new action or not. In light of that ruling, would that have changed the district judge's analysis?
No, Your Honor, based on this English case, but based on this English case, the court determined that even in the same case, state courts are not bound by federal court decisions. And which, so there's that, and then leading to the third reason why the law of the case does not apply here is that there were new facts.
Well, let me ask you about that then. Counsel has represented with a lot of passion that the only distinction between this case and the motion for summary judgment in federal court and the motion for summary judgment before Judge Pickett was one sentence in which you made a convenient 180-degree switch of positions from testimony that had been submitted in affidavits. I'd like to hear your response to that.
Your Honor, this court can look at those affidavits, and we submit that they are not contradictory at all. There is, and that's what the district court determined, was it was complementary. There was additional information added, but none of it was contradictory whatsoever. What the prior affidavit had said is, and we can read this in, there were three affidavits submitted, but the most relevant, the most important, is that filed by the chairwoman of the school board, and Erin H. Mortensen. And what she says in her original affidavit was that I was aware, multiple people were aware, of a propane leak as early as January 2012. Over the next few months, they had Sherman Service and Electric, they had multiple High Plains Propane, they had multiple companies coming out to do testing, and the leak could not be isolated. They knew there was a leak, but their instrumentation was having a difficult time finding it. And the district court thoroughly analyzed this, and what the new affidavit says is, it's simply saying, yes, we were aware of a propane leak, and we knew that was a building code violation. When those affidavits were filed in federal court originally, those affiants believed that that was an obvious thing. And Judge Pickett believed that was obvious too. During the hearing, this court can read through the transcript there in the record. And I have some of that here where there was a discussion between Mr. Wessel and the court where Mr. Wessel made this same argument where he says, I mean, there's nothing new here except for at the Ninth Circuit, what the Ninth Circuit was concerned with and asked Mr. Hall about was when in our record does it say the first time that the school district or Mr. Kearns found out about this propane problem? And the court responds, I think the term was violation of law, not exactly the propane problem, correct? And then the discussion goes on to Mr. Wessel says it has to be a violation of Idaho code. And then the court says, well, but I guess that's part of the question. The argument is propane in a school gym, is propane in a school gym a violation of law? People knew about that in January. The district court, I should say, went on to say, if I smelled propane in the courtroom right now, even though I can't point out what specific code that violates, I know that it's a violation of law. And so he says, the fact that these affidavits have this additional information that was not before the Ninth Circuit, that's very relevant here, is these individuals are saying, we knew of a propane leak, and we knew a leak was a safety concern and it was a building code violation. And so they were working to resolve that problem as early as January 2012. And what the district court then determined and went through the analysis showing that Mr. Barrett was the individual, he was the maintenance supervisor. He was the individual tasked by the school board in January of 2012 to remedy the situation. And he was providing regular status updates. He was tasked with providing regular status updates to the school board, who knew about this issue and knew that it was a building code violation. And so what the district court determined here, what he states in his decision is, it is beyond believable that an employee could be charged with solving a problem, even a building code or safety violation, provide regular progress reports to his employer, discuss the viability of proposed solutions with superiors, And then after being fired, he used those same activities to substantiate a claim of retaliatory discharge. This is especially true when the employee was charged with fixing a problem already known to the employer. Certainly, the statute offers protection to employees who report a violation or suspected violation of law, and it is undisputed that the propane leak was a violation of law. However, there was nothing to report for purposes of the act because the school district already knew about the problem and was trying to fix it. And so that's the uncontested evidence in this case, is that the school district was aware of this. The chairwoman of the school board testified as much, and there's nothing to refute that in the record. So because of that additional evidence, I believe what we were discussing was the law of the case, and the law of the case does not apply because there's this additional evidence that the district court was able to look at.
So let me get this straight. Your argument is, because the school district was working on this problem, they're exempt from whistleblower activity?
Your Honor, because they knew this was a violation of law. And so Mr. Barrett coming, and he alleges he came in and told them, hey, this is a violation of law.
The
because the school board
is,
already knew that.
The timing is an issue that Mr. Wassel is talking about. But so what you're saying is, if the employer knows of a problem and is trying to fix it, there can be no whistleblower act cause
activity.
Of action.
Mm-hmm. Correct, Your Honor. And that is because what the whistleblower act requires is that a person communicate in good faith a violation of law. And what we have not been able to find anything specifically under Idaho, in Idaho on that issue, but deciding a very similarly worded statute in Oregon, the Ninth Circuit stated in the case is Clark versus Multnomah County.
Multnomah.
I'm sure I butchered that name. In that case, the Ninth Circuit states, the plain language of the Oregon statute confirms that merely reporting publicly available information, so the information that's already known, does not constitute a protected disclosure. And so here, there's no protected activity because this was already a widely known dispute.
Counsel, couldn't opposing counsel say that you're really oversimplifying their argument? It's one thing. Let's assume we concede, or they concede, that the school board was aware in 2012 that the propane leak was a building code violation. Let's assume that fact is conceded. Isn't the real issue here is that the plaintiff was continuing to be a thorn in their side by reporting that the remediation efforts weren't taking place the way that they were supposed to, and that by not doing that, that would continue to be a code violation. Isn't that really the essence of the argument? Not that they knew at one time that it was a violation, but that the activities undertaken to remediate weren't sufficient under the code.
Well, Your Honor, if that is the argument, then it's misplaced because Mr. Barrett, the appellant here, was specifically tasked with solving the problem and reporting back to them. That there's no evidence here of any kind of cover-up because they had asked him to solve this. He was the one responsible for engaging in these activities to remediate the problem.
But isn't there evidence in the record that Kearns wanted to reopen the gym in April of 2012 and that Mr. Barrett was resisting that and telling him that would be contrary to the building code and that would constitute a building code violation to allow students to be in an area where there was a known propane leak?
Your Honor, there is evidence in the record that there was an argument there. I do not believe there's evidence in the record to suggest that Mr. Barrett again said that this would be a violation of the building code because of the leak. Because in April, the rationale for reopening the gym was that you're no longer using the furnace. I mean, you're no longer that shut off, and so there would be nothing leaking in the gym. There was evidence to where there was an argument or disagreement between Mr. Barrett and Superintendent Kearns on that issue. But that's not what has been alleged here as the whistleblowing activity. The whistleblowing activity was, from what the appellants allege here, is that they went over Superintendent Kearns' head to the school board to report a building code violation.
Well, but isn't there a big distinction? I mean, it may, let's assume again, as Justice Mueller suggested, that the school board knew that the propane leak from the get-go was a building violation. Isn't it a wholly different matter for an employee to come into an open public school board meeting and to declare the problem publicly to the world?
He was asked to do this, Your Honor, by the school board. And so because he was tasked with it, this was his job as the maintenance supervisor. So he was not coming into the school board to blow any whistle. He was tasked with remedying the situation. And what the district court determined in his analysis, and this is on page 64 of the record, as the school district's maintenance supervisor, responsibility fell to Ryan to identify the problem and fix it. After becoming aware of the problem, Mr. Barrett made his first report on the problem in February in his monthly letter to the school board. Here the court again points out that the issue had already been reported to the school board by Mr. Kearns and was well known throughout the school district and the administration. In his March letter, Ryan reported on the issue again. This time he described the work he had done to identify the problem and fix it. He also informed the school district that they were working on getting bids and things of that nature to solve this. So this was an ongoing process because these companies who the school board was paying to have come out and aware that they were coming out to do this had problems identifying, isolating the issue, isolating the leak in the system. But as the district court determined, there's simply nothing to report. As the district court states in its decision on the motion to reconsider, he says, even if Ryan's assertions are true, even if he was called to testify about or against Mr. Kearns at the school board meeting, what could he have said to qualify him for protection? Ryan does not claim he was terminated for testifying against Mr. Kearns. He claims he was fired for reporting on the propane issue, which was a violation of law. So because this was widely known, there was nothing to report. And that's what the district court determined, and that was proper because he was not bound by the Ninth Circuit's decision. He was allowed to look at the additional evidence in this matter that has been uncontested. And so
is there a transcript of the evidence that Mr. Barrett provided to the school board in May of 2012?
There is, Your Honor.
Where is that in the record?
On the augmented record, page 197, are the minutes from that school board meeting. And what the minutes indicate, I should clarify, I guess it's not a transcript, but it is the minutes.
Are those recorded?
I'm not aware of that, Your Honor.
Okay. I thought they should be.
But we do have the minutes from that. And what it states is, Mr. Barrett stated the propane issues are still a problem. Mr. Holden from Sherman Electric stated the vaporizer is problematic. If the vaporizer is working properly, the furnaces and water heaters can be adjusted properly to allow better efficiency. So that this is part of the ongoing process of solving the propane issue.
Is there any explanation for why Kearns leaves other than Barrett and Sherman testify in the way that they did at the May hearing?
Your Honor, the affidavit of Erin Haight Mortensen there and her affidavit give the court a record citation. That's augmented record 574 is when her affidavit begins. And she states that there's not a lot of information, but what she states is that On or about May 16, 2013, Mr. Kearns met with the school board in executive session and tendered his resignation. Mr. Kearns was not fired, but his resignation was unanimously accepted by the school board.
So he resigned?
He resigned. Okay, he resigned, but...
It's in the record. I see it. Thank you. But his affidavit says that.
Right. His affidavit, her affidavit.
Her affidavit.
But what he did, although he resigned, he stayed on as the superintendent throughout the summer. And so based on the record and the evidence before the district court, there was simply no protected activity. And when we get to Lainey Barrett's claim, you start from the basis of the appellant's claim is that she was the spouse of a whistleblower. That's what they're alleging here.
So it was indicated to me that in the complaint there is an independent cause of action as an employee, that she was fired under her own auspices. In other words, an employment cause of action under her own auspices, not connected to the Whistleblower Act. Is that correct or is that incorrect?
Your Honor, from what has been argued to this court, I believe it's incorrect. Because in the opening brief, appellant's opening brief, this is what they say about this argument. When Idaho enacted the whistleblower statute, it articulated the purpose of the act as follows. And then it goes through the purpose. It quotes the purpose of the act. And then the next sentence is, Lainey Barrett is in need of the protection of this act.
So it's parasitic to the Whistleblower Act.
That's correct.
Not an independent cause of action.
Correct.
I see.
And the starting point for this issue is, in order for her to even possibly have a claim, and this is where the district court begins as well, and he goes on to go through the entire analysis, but if Mr. Barrett was not a whistleblower, then her claim dies because she's arguing that she's the spouse of a whistleblower and should somehow have protection because of that. So if he's not a whistleblower, she has, even what she's alleged, can't happen.
Mr. Jacobson, I want to ask you a similar question that I asked Mr. Wessel. If, and let's not call it this case, let's say in a hypothetical case, a husband is a whistleblower via Company X. Company X fires whistleblower's wife in response to the public company X activity. Is that an adverse action that is sustained by the husband in a whistleblower action?
Your Honor, it would be only if the statute provides for that. And in this case...
Well, the statute talks about an adverse action. Or I can't remember the exact language, but it's... if there's adversity that has been experienced by the whistleblower, then there's recourse. Is that within the ambit of the statute?
No, Your Honor. The only thing that would be within the ambit of the statute is an adverse action directly taken against Mr. Barrett in this case.
But if the evidence shows unequivocally that the firing of the spouse occurs because of the protected activity of the whistleblower, why isn't that an adverse action?
Because it wasn't taken directly against the person who engaged in the activity. There are statutes that provide for a third party, what would be a third party retaliation claim. And the appellants have cited to those. Under the ADA, the language of the statute is broad enough that it includes third parties. But the language that we have under the whistleblower statute is not broad and would not include that. No court has said that it did, and we believe it's in the province of the legislature. If the legislature wished to include
a third party... Well, the legislature has told us that if it's an adverse action, then it's recoverable. What takes the firing of the spouse out of the coverage of an adverse action?
Your Honor, we believe because it's not taken directly against the the whistleblower.
But not because of the language itself?
Well, because we believe the language indicates, the language of the statute indicates that it would only be against the whistleblower himself. It's adverse action taken against the person who reported, who engaged in protected activity.
Well, let's say the HR director of the public entity X says, we fired her because of the whistleblowing activity of the husband. Is the public entity immune from any action brought by the husband as it relates to the husband? It's a community property state. If her income is community property, why isn't that an adverse action against the husband?
Well, there's no case law to say that it wouldn't.
We're just trying to figure things out.
Right. And really, looking at this case, the best response that I can provide is that there was no protected activity to fall under the whistleblower statute. And so,
that's not answering my question. I'm trying to figure out what the law is as it relates to a whistleblower. I mean, let's assume, for purposes of my question, that there was protected activity. The HR director says, we fired her because of what he said and the whistle that he blew. Why wouldn't that be an adverse action against him?
Well, Your Honor, that would be indirect.
Well, certainly indirect, but it's an... But,
well, I don't know, take away 50% of my wages. That'd be direct.
Okay, I'm not going to concede indirect.
But, Your Honors, we would respectfully request that the court affirm the district court's decision.
Thank you. How much time does the appellant have?
3 minutes.
Sir.
Thank you. I'll just point out, on page 32 of the record, this is the complaint demand for jury trial. There is a separate and distinct action for paragraph 55 of the complaint. The termination for employment was also a common law action that is contrary to the public policy of the state of Idaho. The complaint is asking for a separate and distinct action for that. I also just, I'm long time, I just like to ask a rhetorical question. If the court smelled a propane smell in this courtroom today, what would you think? Well, let's say it was yesterday when all the school kids were here. What would you think? Right, you'd think that they let off a stink bomb in the courtroom. Would you automatically go to, well, whatever this courtroom was built, you know, years and years ago, something was built wrong. And would you automatically know that's a building code violation that happened? Or would you think, well, maybe it's a maintenance issue. Maybe there is a pilot light that was left on, or maybe there's just a pipe that needs to be fixed. It's not like anyone broke any law. You wouldn't know. And the district court, it was improper for him to take judicial notice that the smell of propane in old gym was a building code violation. And if you look at Mr. Kern's affidavit and all the affidavits that the school district submitted, you'll see right after they say we knew that a propane leak was a building code violation, the very next sentence is that we had High Plains Propane come out and look and no one could find a leak. And so the question before the court, what the court took judicial notice of, is that the smell of propane in a building equals a building code violation. But there's nothing in the record where either the school district or the district court actually said, well, this is the law that is violated. This is the provision of building code violation that's violated by the smell of propane. The only thing in your record that shows a violation of law, rule, or regulation, which is required under the whistleblower statute, is the letter from Sermon Service and Electric addressed to Ryan Barrett, that Ryan Barrett handed to Mr. Kearns on March 12th. And at that meeting, Mr. Barrett's affidavit says, Kearns told him, keep quiet about this, don't tell anyone. There's your cover-up. And this is a motion for summary judgment, so the court has to take that as true. And if that happened, he is a whistleblower. If you look at the English case, this is not a lower federal court. This is the Ninth Circuit. The English case is about a district court going from federal court to a state court. And the question was, can the state court on appeal overrule that the district court and federal district court's opinion? It didn't.
Counsel, one last question. In the record on the augmented record on page 571 is the letter terminating your client's employment. I know you believe it was pretextual, but in that regard, part of the allegations were made by the school district 5 months or more after these incidents were involving the propane, was that your client had posted information on the internet and on Facebook that was inappropriate, and those were the purported grounds for his termination. Is there anything to suggest that those reasons are based on a falsehood?
Well, two answers. If you look at the Curley opinion, Curley, the Idaho Supreme Court case, said that you don't do a McDonnell-Douglas analysis where you have a prima facie case, the school district comes back with a legitimate non-discriminatory reason, and then the plaintiff has to prove pretext. You don't do that in this type of case. You just have to have a prima facie case.
Right, and so this, where this happened 5 months later, okay, approximately 5 months later.
Right, but 1 month after.
I'm just curious, right. Have you denied those allegations that your client did post inappropriate remarks and embarrassing information on the internet that may have provided an alternative basis for discharge?
Yes, my client has denied that. There are actually two allegations. One of those was, if you read it, it's in his affidavit, it was where he said, I've worked for the school district for so long and I only make $800 a month. I shouldn't have had to take a $300 pay cut just because Mr. Kearns would not address a propane issue. That's a Facebook. It's another blowing the whistle for Facebook. I see that now.
That's fine. Thank you. Matters under advisement. We'll render a decision.